So.
Here it is. Big blue book. So the Book of Gates is a text that appears out of nowhere in Egypt, just after the Akhenaten period. Now, this is around about 1600 years BCE. So that's 3,500 years ago. It's thought to be much older than that, coming from sometime in the Middle Kingdom period of Egypt. So to put it probably, it's somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 years old is what it's believed. But its actual appearance we find first of all in the tomb of somebody called Horemheb, who is the general who creates the revival of Egyptian culture after the Amarna period, when the pharaoh Amenhotep III, who then calls himself Akhenaten, creates a new religion and nearly destroys Egypt in the process. And Akhenaten is this interesting kind of figure, really, who when he was first discovered in the 19th century, Egyptologists of that time were very excited by him and thought he was the first ever monotheist. And therefore he was seen as this visionary figure who understood the true nature of God, as opposed to the barbaric Egyptians who have these gods with funny heads. Animal heads. Now, in practice, what we have learned, what Egyptology has learned, as the Amarna period has been discovered, is actually he wasn't even a monotheist. Basically, his god, the sun god, the Aten, he did believe there were lots of other gods, but he thought his god was the best. So and he believed that all the other gods did exist, but they were kind of devils. And so he's equivalent, really, of a sort of a Christian terms of a Puritan preacher who kind of checks out all the other images. So if you like the religious tradition in Britain, this would be the equivalent of the Puritans kind of stripping out all the churches and closing all the churches and creating what is a new religion. But the religion is the religion of Akhenaten and his family. Now, you get beautiful artworks from the Amarna period about Akhenaten and his family, and it looks very beautiful. And I can understand why people thought Akhenaten was amazing and visionary, and you get the beautiful art. But it was all predicated on the fact that Akhenaten and his family were literally divine. Bless you. And that everybody needed to worship Akhenaten and his family, who were the sons of the sun, sons and daughters of the sun. Now, that's a strong tradition in Egypt. Pharaohs are often seen as the son of the sun, the son of Ra, daughter of Ra, if it's a female pharaoh. But the thing that was different about Akhenaten's vision is it was absolutely absolute. So he closed all Egyptian temples. Egyptian temples were not just temples. They were economic entities. They were places where justice was done. So he essentially dismantled all the state institutions and grabbed most...
Good works as well.
Yeah, they did. They feared the poor, grain. They were responsible for looking after the grain stores, and so all this gets swept away. And he grabs, of course, does what most tyrants do, grabs most of the loot, very much like Henry VIII did, and when he closed the monasteries. Yeah, and he sets off to build this new city called Amarna, which is situated a staggeringly ridiculous distance away from the Nile. So there are lots of water problems. But he has a vision that that's where it needs to be. And during Akhenaten's period, Egypt suffers economically, militarily. There's enormous malnutrition among the population, lots of infant and child death. So he nearly destroys the kind of the whole fabric of Egyptian society. So what happens during the Akhenaten period is that this very stable and very rich society, because the fertility of the Nile Valley is famous, has always made Egypt this very rich. Rich country, you know, in Roman imperial days, Egypt was the breadbasket of the empire, because it's where they got most of their wheat and barley to make bread from. So it's a major feat to destroy a society that prosperous, but that's pretty much what Akhenaten nearly did.
This is studying just his lifetime. Because
to build
a whole
city
and all of that, when they even lived that long in those.
Oh yeah, this was only about 20 years, Rob. This was all over a 20-year period.
And they managed to build a whole.
He built an enormous city. Yes, he did. Well, it was very. I mean, in Egypt is this very centrally controlled society. Right, so it's very, very hierarchical. Pharaoh is literally in control of everything, which is why you get these astonishing monuments. The whole society, there was never slave. I mean, in the older traditions, it wasn't slavery. It was people cooperating together. So this was a society that was capable of doing extraordinary things like that. But so what you see, what happened, literally happened in the Amarna period, is the capital of Thebes, which had the old capital, was completely abandoned and stripped out and destroyed, and they all moved 50 miles south, down to Amarna, and they build this new city. You know, and Egypt does it. Egypt does this at the moment. They're currently building new Cairo. About 10 miles out of Cairo, they're building New Cairo, which is a fucking enormous city. It's kind of that's being created, and the whole governments and all the bureaucratic institutions are planning to move out there. So there's just something in Egyptian cultural tradition where they love a good mammoth project and are willing to do that.
Because in Britain, you go, if a cathedral was being built, the son would take over his father's job in the building.
Yeah, no, this is a much more. So now this whole thing happens. So if you imagine over around about a 20-year period, if you imagine all state institutions being destroyed, and all religious systems being stopped, all the priests turned out. So the hundreds of priests, God, you know, just chaos. You can imagine. So what gets created here is total kind of chaos. And one man's vision trumping everybody else's visions.
And he used slavery big star.
Hmm?
He used slavery big star.
Well, yeah, I mean, so what you see is his one vision kind of being imposed on everybody else. And it's a really powerful example of the authority, you know, if one person's vision prevails, there is community is destroyed. Even in a very centralized society, they were used to obeying Pharaoh. The extent to which he destroyed the underpinnings of this culture sent it into total chaos. The army goes into chaos, the agriculture goes into chaos, everything, you know, the whole bloody thing starts to fall apart. So what happens is he dies. We don't know how, we can maybe imagine. We have this kind of period really that where Tutankhamun, the famous Tutankhamun, famous because because he was so insignificant, he all his treasures got missed. So this child appears and is a young pharaoh, not there for very long. He takes over Egypt and he is part of the restoration of the old ways. His original name was Tutankhaten. The Tutankhamun means my life is held in the god Amun. Tutankhaten means was his original name, because my life is held in the god Aten, the sun god, who is the god of his father, Akhenaten. So chaos. Right, so what happens is that Tutankhamun dies, and all kinds of theories about that. But then a person called Ay takes over, and he in turn is succeeded by Horemheb, who is a general. And his friend, the high priest of Amun, re-establish what then becomes called the New Kingdom. Now the New Kingdom is still thousands years. The New Kingdom is 3,500 to 4,000 years back from here, where we are now. And it's called the New Kingdom, of course, because actually it's a couple of thousand years back of continuity of Egyptian civilization. So the Book of Gates appears in the tomb of Horemheb, and it's part of a whole process of restoration. And it's an extraordinary text, thought to be at least possibly another 1,000 years older than the written version. And it's probably one of the earliest mystical texts that we have in Western tradition. Now, the great thing about Egyptian tradition and why it's helpful to us is it does its whole thing. It goes on from that point of 1600 BCE, we go down into the Christian era when Rome is in charge of Egypt, and there is a great continuity that happens between then and then, and in the Arab period, it's partly Coptic, partly then Arab period, people start to forget how to read hieroglyphics. And what happens is that certainly by the time we come into the kind of very early Middle Ages, no one knows how to read these things, and so literally the sands of the desert cover them over. So, for example, there are temples now that have been excavated in Egypt that there were villages actually on the roof of them, and they didn't know there was a temple underneath them. They literally are covered over. What also is covered over, of course, is all the meaning and understanding, because people can't read hieroglyphics anymore. Until the 19th century, as a result of the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, suddenly we start to be able to read hieroglyphs again. So these are like kind of time capsules, literally time capsules, that suddenly open up. And we start to be able to read these things again. Now what we get to read mostly, I mean there are some exceptions, but mostly what we discover is the literature that talks about Egyptians' relationship to their own spirituality and to their experience of life and death and afterlife. Because this is a society that was very focused upon the experience of the spiritual and the spiritual's connection to the physical. They're very focused on the spiritual and the spiritual's connection to the physical. So the whole process around mummification, the whole process around creating structures where the dead are remembered, really has a lot to do with their belief and experience that the spiritual world and the physical world are in constant communion and dialogue. Now, one of our issues when we come across this big blue book is how do we read it? How do we engage with it? What does it mean? It's full of images, it's full of phrases. This is actually a very good translation by Michael Shepherd, but all translations are obviously just translations as well. So we're confronted, you know, so I say to you, right, I know guys will look at this for 2 years. Excellent. Got the book? Go. Now, unless you have a lot of understanding of Egyptian tradition, when you thumb through this, there's some interesting pictures, but it actually would probably feel a bit daunting. It's not daunting, I'm impressed with you, but it certainly daunts me at times. Because, and of course, the other question would be, well, why bother with this? Why do we, you know, what's the point of doing this? Well, one of the points of doing it is because actually we, by studying something like this, we enter into a worldview that was really based around the communion between the spiritual and the physical. And then in particular, given our subject, really understood the nature of the embodied image. This is a culture that and a spirituality that is all based around the embodiment of the spiritual. And the embodiment of the spiritual by working with images that act as a sort of that act as living icons that allow the uncreate life to pass through the living image into physical and emotional experience. Now this dynamic that we've looked at other times about images being either icons or idols is right at the heart of this process that we're going to be looking at. And to remind you, an icon is an image that is transparent, that points us towards a mysterious light that deepens our awareness and deepens our vision of ourselves and the world we live in. An idol is an opaque image which limits meaning and dominates meaning, that tyrannizes. And one of the things that we look at when we work in this way is to work with the experience of the images that we contain within us that are iconic and the images that we contain within us that are idols. The example of a personal idol might be, I always get things wrong. Or a more externally orientated idol would be, nobody ever sees how good I am. Now, the problem really, in a sense, with our known sense of self and known self of world is it is essentially a functional idol. Which, if we have done work on ourselves, normally has little gaps, or little windows, which are iconic, that lets in a deeper sense of light and awareness. So the reason really for working with this complex book full of complex images and curious and mysterious images is we're in a way bringing in the help of a society and a culture that really understood how to work with images, how to transform idols into icons. And how in particular to work with opposites so as to, in such a way that a quality they called ma'at is maintained, which is a sort of a living balance and a creative balance between opposites that promotes life.
Can you say that again?
The Egyptian society really understood how to work with the experience of opposites in such a way that to promote a quality they called a ma'at, M-A-A-T, which is the balance between opposites that promotes life. Okay, we'll stop there. Let's have a half hour break, have something to eat.